You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday, the 3rd of February, 2022, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live today at RadioAlbion.com because we have with us geopolitical analyst Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson from RussJournal.org. Matt, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Well, I have a confession to make. It's a little on the embarrassing side, but I found myself completely addicted to the reality show My 600-Pound Life. Apparently, laughing at morbidly obese people is now my new hobby. So I just had to get that off my chest. I hope you don't mind.
Well, we always have to find people who've got things worse off than ourselves to make our own lives feel a little bit better, I think. So I don't think you should feel too guilty about that, Matt. But today's subject, we have visited it before, but we're going to get into more detail on it today. We're going to be talking about Klaus Schwab's Great Reset. So we're basically going to have a review of the Great Reset, and we have a couple of op-eds that we're going to use as the basis for that. And the first one is from Konrad Rikas from Global Research. And we use Global Research quite a lot on this Thursday show. They're quite a reputable site. He says, generally speaking, the message is that without owning a flat, we are not only more flexible on the labour market, but also more free, happy, and of course, modern. And in fact, the initial assumptions of such visions were probably related to the desire to intensify the globalization of the labor market to facilitate labor migrations, etc. However, as so often happens today, the practical idea was quickly associated with the ideological concept, in this case with the expropriation trend. At this point, a Marxist would mention accumulation by dispossession, and a liberal would criticise the deprivation of a holy right of property, and they would both shudder in disgust, albeit probably in opposite directions. The joke, however, is that when properly given, the same idea immediately begins to be liked by some representatives of the same trends. In fact, this expropriation is associated with the accumulation of property, and is carried out at the hands of corporates and neo-elites, not the state. Of course, modern states would not mind treating housing and other goods as rewards for obedience, while restricting access to them for everyone outside the system. Contrary to appearances, in this respect, neoliberal and neo-progressive positions are not so distant from each other. However, the effect in both cases is very similar. Expropriation is often accompanied by uprooting, and a man without property transforms into the man without qualities. So quite a lot there, Matt, particularly talking about property here. And I guess the difference between the communist idea of losing all property is that it was owned by the state, and now it's going to be owned by BlackRock. But that seems to me to be the only difference. What else is different about this?
Well, it's a lot of pompous language to deal with something pretty simple. Expropriation is a technical term that comes from Marx that refers to the difference between the value of the object that's sold in the market and the amount of money that the worker gets paid. And the difference between the two is profit. Over time, that gap grows wider and wider, and labor is paid just enough to survive. And of course, in that sense, it's at least partially right. That's really what he means here. As I've said a billion times on this show and elsewhere, state and corporate property based on expropriation and immiseration, are more or less the same. I mean, even Marx refused to deal with the fact that they become one entity. You know, he says that the state is a bodyguard to capital, which is certainly true, but this has gone a lot further than that. and now the state and capital are, I can't tell the difference. So he's mixing a few ideas here and using this kind of language, but that's what he's talking about. For example, the minimum wage. The minimum wage hasn't kept up with labor productivity. I mean, American workers are extremely productive. If the minimum wage kept up with worker productivity, it would be something like $70 an hour now at a minimum. Well, it's not. It's like $8. So where does all that extra production go? Where does all that extra value go? And we know where it goes. And to a great extent, that's another way of putting what he just said here. The language is a little bit too flowery, but that's at the root what we're talking about.
Well, we also want to have a look at apparently the free tech model, because that's what is being applied in the real world here. However, in the case of housing, the speculative bubble that periodically increases is a fairly obvious threat to the stability of financial markets and council or state-owned extensive construction and housing systems still remain a natural protective and regulatory measure in many countries. Meanwhile, the same system for all other ownership, replaced by subscription systems and short-term borrowing, must already raise more than a concern. For now, it works in the virtual world, software, especially games and music sharing. The not-so-unimaginable futurism brings visions of worlds in which, on the same principle, also material goods and even food will be made available from the codes of 3D printers, etc. After all, even Star Trek showed us the world of some neo-communism or omni-corporation without money and with all goods granted so miraculously to humanity. Considering that in the globalist and neoliberal realities, states and international organizations remain only as the far-reaching executive organs of capital, previous disputes as to whether it is better to accumulate the ownership and means of production in the hands of the state or in private monopolies loses its importance altogether. And that's what you were saying there, Matt, isn't it? That the state has become captive to capital. Interestingly, a world without widespread private property would also actually be a world without tradition, or maybe rather with a tradition that is invented and generated over and over again, adjusted to the needs of the current stage of modernity. The lack of material culture inextricably linked to ownership also questions the very meaning and possibility of the existence of culture in general, and this would result in the end of the civilization as we know it. And this will be post-modernity of all the dreams and fears of both neo-communists and neoliberals. Post-modernity in which property actually seems to have disappeared, but ultimately remaining in the hands of so few. And I think this is part of it, isn't it? That they want to replace our traditions with new traditions that they think up themselves. Would I be correct in thinking that, Matt?
Yeah, this is actually a pretty serious statement that he's making. We often don't think of tradition and nationality and ethnicity as having something to do with ownership, but it really does. Not in the liberal sense of this legal control over an object. You can do whatever you want with it. This is a communal property. There's a big difference between a communal property and a collective property. The collective farm in the Soviet Union was owned by the state. There was no tradition there at all. People who had no connection to each other were just herded together and under the aegis of a Jewish party that had no connection with the land whatsoever, they faced starvation. But tradition, which of course was the enemy of the Soviet Union and any system that imitates it, the enemy of liberalism, the enemy of pretty much anything but what we talk about here, can be weaponized. Rebellions, especially in centuries ago, rebellions were based on the violation of tradition. These communal properties, ever since the enclosures centuries ago, it's the same concept. Turning all community property into collective property, something controlled by the very few. And remember, these guys have no culture themselves. They have no ethnicity. They have no other than the Judaic one. Culture is only a weapon. It's only good for them when they could weaponize it against their enemies. So, black culture or Hispanic culture against us, something like that. The other thing that struck me here is short-term loans. And I think I briefly talked about Quicken Loans has seen, I think, a 200% growth in profit for its owner. Quicken Loans and their competitors are short-term, very high interest rate loans for the poor. It is the ultimate definition of usury. And he's saying here, I think without referencing it, that Quicken Loans is one of the huge gains of the elite since the lockdown. And so these people are paying massive compound interest because, you know, they have nothing. So this is just the beginning here. So there's so much packed into this. But the connection between ownership and tradition, the difference between community and collective, is all important. But this kind of vocabulary is normally not the day-to-day vocabulary of the average person. So, and I've noticed too, and when the media talks about financial matters, they use phrases like quantitative easing, which are totally out of the ken of your typical newspaper reader or TV watcher. They get so technical that really no normal person can follow it unless you're like us. And I think they do that on purpose. The miraculous goods made, meaning that these people don't know where it comes from. They have no concept of it. And when it is described, it's done in such technical terms that no one can follow it. And that's what they're doing on purpose. So these are just weapons that the regime uses to destroy the very tradition that lies at the root of nationalism and nations in general.
I think loans and credit are only available because they've done away with the tradition. I mean, we always used to be taught to save up and not to use loans, not to use credit for anything. You should save up if you want something. I don't think credit cards even came about until about 50 years ago. Now everything goes on the credit card. It's generated and then it has to be paid back rather than it being money that you've already generated that's gone into the system. So it just builds up and it builds up and the interest builds up and smaller group of people end up taking all the wealth from a much larger group of people. Well, the next article we have here is by a Colin Todhunter, and it's actually a couple of years old, and it's again from Global Research. He says, the Great Reset entails a transformation of society, resulting in permanent restrictions on fundamental liberties and mass surveillance as entire sectors are sacrificed to boost the monopoly and hegemony of pharmaceutical corporations, high-tech and big data giants, Amazon, Google, major global chains, the digital payments sector, biotech concerns, and more. Using COVID-19 lockdowns and restrictions to push through this transformation, the Great Reset is being rolled out under the guise of a fourth industrial revolution, in which older enterprises are to be driven into bankruptcy or absorbed into monopolies, effectively shutting down huge sections of the pre-COVID economy. Economies are being restructured, and many jobs will be carried out by AI-driven machines. The jobless, and there will be many, could be placed on some kind of universal basic income, and have their debts, indebtedness, and bankruptcy on a massive scale is the deliberate result of lockdowns and restrictions. They can have their debts written off in return for handing their assets over to the state, or more precisely, the financial institutions helping to drive this Great Reset. The World Economic Forum says the public will rent everything they require, stripping the right of ownership under the guise of sustainable consumption and saving the planet. Of course, the tiny elite who rolled out this Great Reset will actually own everything. Hundreds of millions around the world deemed surplus to requirements are to be robbed, or are currently being robbed, of their livelihoods. Our every movement and purchase are to be monitored, and our main dealings will be online. And of course, if you engage in any wrongthink at all, then you won't be able to transact business online. You won't be able to have a bank account. And if they own all the property, as we were saying earlier, they'll just say, well, you're not a part of the system. You can't have any property. I think this experiment with universal basic income, they've done that in Finland, haven't they? And I think they've done that in Holland. And this furlough that we had over here in Britain, this was pretty similar. People got used to it. They don't want to give it up. I mean, it will be very tempting for a lot of people to just get paid and give up their liberties in return for it. What do you think, Matt?
We've dealt with this issue before. I think this is our third Great Reset show, and I think we should do more. It's one of two things. As I said before, either they use very technical language that no one can follow, or maybe worse, using slogans like saving the planet, sustainable consumption. These people couldn't define that if their lives depended on it. But I think I've said this before, but the quickest and easiest way to define what the Great Reset is to say that the debt the average household debt will be nullified in exchange for giving up everything they own to the regime. And then they'll be put on a basic income and they'll be able to rent everything from that. Production, actually productive jobs, will be completely in the third world or handled by AI, as they mention here. But that's the simplest way to put it. And the other aspect of this, and this has been going on for a very long time, but COVID made it much easier, is that when you drive an economy into depression, which you know has been the case long before COVID, that's something that Trump said that I did not particularly appreciate, the greatest economy of all time, it's nonsense. When you drive small businesses who really can't handle this kind of stuff for very long, the rich can now are the only ones left to buy them up at bargain basement prices. And then when there's any kind of vague recovery, the value goes up and then they become wealthier and wealthier and wealthier. And that's how all these, you know, everyone from Elon Musk, who I think has had a 500% increase in his wealth since the first lockdown. That's how that works, because a small business, usually struggling to begin with, can't handle a depression for very long. A huge corporation can. They can ride it out. So when the small guys go bankrupt, the big guys come in and at pennies on the dollar, buy it up. And that's how you have these massive increases in wealth for the elite, for the regime. And the greatest part of it from their point of view is that they could blame something that no one can see, a virus. Which is, you know, that there've been horror movies about viruses. This has been in the public arena for a long time. It's not their greed. It's not the system. It's not ideology. It's not the expropriation of traditional that stuff. It's a virus, and there's nothing we could do about that. It's not our fault. So it's really the perfect cover. No one could have predicted this 10 years ago.
And of course, once the virus is over, they'll move on to climate change, and it's because of climate change that we all have to stay at home and not work and pay extra taxes. Well, they have a plan for countries, not just for citizens. The plan for individual citizens could reflect the strategy to be applied to nation states. For instance, World Bank Group President David Malpass has stated that poorer countries will be helped to get back on their feet after the various lockdowns that have been implemented. This help will be on condition that neoliberal reforms and the undermining of public services are implemented and become further embedded. On the 20th of April, the Wall Street Journal ran the headline, IMF, World Bank face deluge of aid requests from developing world. Scores of countries are asking for bailouts and loans from financial institutions with a $1.2 trillion to lend, an ideal recipe for fueling dependency. In return for debt relief or support, global conglomerates, along with the likes of Bill Gates, will be able to further dictate national policy and hollow out the remnants of nation-state sovereignty. What will happen to our social and personal identity? Is that to be eradicated in the quest to commodify and standardize human behavior and everything we do? I mean, where does this $1.2 trillion come from? That the IMF has to lend out to the developing world. And who sets the limit on the amount that they can lend when they're not actually lending anything of substance? What's going on here, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, at this point, just printing money is the norm without any thought for inflation. This is what happens when you have a ruling class, a regime, that has no faith in its own future. Having no faith in its own future, is at least in the long term, means that they could simply live on printing money, asset stripping, all of these, you know, last minute things to completely expropriate and to destroy the working class, knowing full well that they really don't have a intelligent source of information. People like us are banned and censored beyond belief. Many of us have gone to jail, especially in Europe, especially in continental Europe. So this money can come from anywhere. You know, not only do they have the World Bank, the IMF, these are just a consortium. It's a consortium of the big banks. And these are the same big banks that are controlled by BlackRock. So ultimately, it's simply BlackRock and Vanguard under different guises and different names. So they can print all the money they want. I've said this before, and so has Paul Craig Roberts, that you can have a total implosion of the global economy and have no one notice. You could have a massive white homeless problem. you could have a massive invasion of Europe and the U.S. from the third world to lower labor costs even farther and to shut us down with threats of violence from these people. You could do all this and no one will notice, because or no one would, well, number one, people don't think systematically. And number two, everything, every source of information that could talk about this has been shut down, including entire police departments. So I guess this means I got places in Sweden, the no-go areas, the invasion, everything will be federalized, or even beyond that. Police departments and everything will be completely federalized or globalized. And there's very little that we can do. I mean, as of right now, with a few exceptions, we don't really have any organized resistance. Who wants to be a nationalist leader in America or Britain today? It's almost a guaranteed prison term. So that means only lunatics will be willing to do it. And dependency, of course, is another technical term. It means you could take a developing country that has many sectors, and because of conditions of these kind of loans and everything else, they end up being just raw materials producers and nothing else. They can't put up protective walls, so they'll be cut off from credit. So they have to then be inserted into the global economy, which means that all of these countries in the third world have to be based on usually one commodity, and therefore totally dependent, both domestically and internationally, on institutions like the IMF, or just a global system in general. The only countries that are broken out of this, you think of like South Korea in the 60s, is a very strong populist military government that, well, in the case of Park Chung-hee, my favorite, greatest Asian leader, brought all of these elites into prison and said, if you follow me, I'll let you out. And if not, you stay here, and the people who will follow me will take over everything you have. And from then, South Korea went from a fourth world, really a basket case after the Korean War, to a beyond first world power. And military governments, you know, especially in culturally homogenous places, in Taiwan, Thailand, have done very well. That's pretty much the only chance they have. And this is why the regime talks about this democracy nonsense over and over and over again. Because I know that there is a way out. The very opposite of a way out is dependency.
Well, it's not just all about materialism and making profits. I mean, as it says here, it will be so that they can implement neoliberal progressive policies and this ideology that these neo elites wish the rest of the world to have. It's like they think they're gods, they're Greek deities, particularly with the power that they have over people, over entire countries now. When you think you've got these captains of industry that are now sending rockets into space because NASA can't afford to do it. You got people that own supermarket chains that own more than the rocket industry in America, basically, more than NASA. The billionaire class who are pushing this agenda think that they can own nature and all humans and can control both, whether through geoengineering the atmosphere, for example, genetically modifying soil microbes, or doing a better job than nature by producing biosynthesized fake food in a lab. They think they can bring history to a close and reinvent the wheel by reshaping what it means to be human. And they think they can achieve this by 2030. It is a cold dystopian vision that wants to eradicate thousands of years of culture, tradition and practices virtually overnight. And it does. It's as if they think that they can do better than nature. They're just trying to reinvent nature with food and genetic modification. And they're talking about not using wombs anymore. What do you make of these crazy ideas that they have here, where they think they're better than nature itself, Matt?
Well, that's the basis of the Arcana. That's the basis of the Kabbalah and the occult in general. I mean, this is why guys like Michael Hoffman and E. Michael Jones are so extremely valuable. Those are the two men that changed my life. And they were the first ones when I was in grad school to explain this idea. And it comes from liberalism itself, which is what liberalism is. You know, John Locke, one of the originators, held that there is no such thing as nature. Nature has absolutely no value until it's transformed into something and owned by someone who works on it. That's what nature is. Nature has been completely eliminated. Nature is what science says it is. It can be made into anything. Yeah, and of course, it's not mankind who does that. It's the elite who do this. Then they'll change the language, totally manipulate science, which is central to all of this stuff. So it's, you know, it's the arcana that became liberalism. This was something the medievals and the ancients had no concept of. Reduce everything to just random atoms in motion, atoms in the void. And the concept of tikkun olam, which we all know, comes from the Kabbalah. It means to fix or to heal or something like that, heal the world, under the power of the those who have been initiated and who know the secrets of the so-called natural order, which, of course, they deny. There's no such thing as species. There's no such thing as ecosystems. These are the creation of the scientific elite. And that's how they think. That's what alchemy is based on. Nature doesn't really exist. It's all based on this vague, you know, atoms in the void. And therefore, when you know the secrets, you can turn it into whatever you want. Now, of course, alchemy had more to do with people than turning lead into gold. But that's the basic idea. This is an ancient concept that now technology has taken over. Technology is based on the idea that they're fixing, you know, it's one thing to have a technological order that works with nature, you know, like wind power or something like that. No, no, no. Now, this is based on replacing nature entirely. That's the concept behind the Industrial Revolution. It comes straight from the Arcana. And they're talking about second and third industrial revolutions. This has nothing to do with industry, but it does have to do with ideology. It's all about how science presents the world, you know, science being, you know, an establishment controlled by elite money. Having nothing to do with reality. You know, I have a book that I'm just finishing now on nominalism, which goes into this in great detail. If there are no universal concepts, that means nature doesn't exist. Nature itself is a universal concept. It implies an order. That's what's being denied here. Nominalism is the foundation of things like the Industrial Revolution and everything that came afterwards. Now in postmodernity, you have an even more extreme version. Postmodernism is based now explicitly in the fact that not only does nature not exist, but neither does the individual. It's all based on language and how the regime presents reality. They decide what's real and what isn't.
Well, they tell us they can turn green mold into beefsteak now, don't they? They're telling us that we should be eating these tasty bugs because they taste good. Well, many of those cultures, traditions and practices that they wish to get rid of relate to food and how we produce it and our deep-rooted connections to nature. Consider that many of the ancient rituals and celebrations of our forebears were built around stories and myths that help them come to terms with some of the most basic issues of existence, from death to rebirth and fertility. These culturally embedded beliefs and practices serve to sanctify their practical relationship with nature and its role in sustaining human life. As agriculture became key to human survival, the planting and harvesting of crops and other seasonal activities associated with food production were central to these customs. Freyfaxi marks the beginning of the harvest in Norse paganism, for example, while Lammas or Lunasa is the celebration of the first harvest or grain harvest in paganism. Humans celebrated nature and the life that it gave birth to. Ancient beliefs and rituals were imbued with hope and renewal, and people had a necessary and immediate relationship with the sun, seeds, animals, wind, fire, soil, and rain, and the changing seasons that nourished them and brought to life. Our cultural and social relationships with agrarian production and associated deities had a sound, practical base. Well, will the elites try to impose new traditions and rituals on us, do you think? Maybe linked to the latest release of a product range from Amazon. I mean, we already have similar, don't we, with iPhone releases and queues stretching down the streets days in advance to get the latest model. I mean, these are sort of replacing our old traditions. I think they believe that they can give us new ones, don't you think?
Or just produce a human being that's not really human. I mean, my God, they're not producing food. They're producing food-like products based on, you know, chemicals or genetic manipulation. You know, the old farmer class, you know, Jefferson held to the view that the only real independent person is the mid-level landowner, not extremely wealthy, and of course not poor, because the poor are totally dependent. And you really can't, you know, you trust someone's ideology when they're dependent on someone else. They have to go. The yeoman farmer, that is the independent, the actually independent farmer, has always been the threat to the regime now for centuries. To a great extent, the Enlightenment was based on destroying it. This is the fulfillment of liberalism and the Enlightenment, now centuries old. Now the technology exists where you can totally cut people off from any connection to anybody. And now you have a virus where people now are afraid to stand close to one another. mean, you see it. You go to the store, and people just now habitually stand, you know, 10 feet from each other. Now, of course, I was doing that long before COVID, but now this is something that is now habitual. There is no trust. Institutions, I know this is actually the subject of a book, bowling alleys are closing down because bowling leagues are gone. And this has been going on for decades. People don't trust one another. These institutions, these traditions, I don't care where they come from, are being closed down. And what do you have left? You don't really have humans left anymore. You have totally dependent animals living for their appetites only that now can only get those satisfied at a price, and that price is ownership of anything. And so what he's talking about here is a celebration of the natural order and natural law. Well, these people are talking about the natural order now doesn't exist. So all of these go out the window. The farmer, anyone connected with this, any tradition whatsoever, including the family, which is not, this is all natural law, celebrating this natural law goes out the window. And now you're pumping them full of chemicals. What are you going to have? This has been going on a lot longer than COVID, but COVID has, you know, has been a gas pedal for all of this stuff. And they don't have to be blamed for it. You're talking about the creation of non-humans.
Well, I think they've taken our imaginations away from us as well and replaced them with their own imagination, with Hollywood and movies and cartoons. Children imagine things in the way that they've seen things on a screen now instead of really making the most use of their imagination. Professor Robert W. Nichols explains that the cults of Woden and Thor were superimposed on far older and better rooted beliefs related to the sun and the earth, the crops and the animals, and the rotation of the seasons between the light and warmth of summer and the cold and dark of winter. We need look no further than India to appreciate the important relationship between culture, agriculture, and ecology, not least the vital importance of the monsoon and seasonal planting and harvesting. Rural-based beliefs and rituals steeped in nature persist, even among urban Indians. These are bound to traditional knowledge systems where livelihoods, the seasons, food, cooking, processing, seed exchange, healthcare, and the passing on of knowledge are all interrelated and form the essence of cultural diversity within India itself. Although the industrial age resulted in a diminution of the connection between food and the natural environment as people moved to cities, traditional food cultures, the practices, attitudes, and beliefs surrounding the production, distribution, and consumption of food still thrive and highlight our ongoing connection to agriculture and nature. Well, if they replace all of that and they fail, who is going to be left that actually remembers how to utilize nature? I mean, we're already forgetting our memories, aren't we? We used to be able to remember a whole phone book, and now we have the smartphone that does that. I mean, you can extend that to just about everything that we do, that we used to do, that we're forgetting how to do it. I mean, just who's going to step up if everybody's forgotten how to do all of this, do you think?
The only way to do this, and I'm not sure we have the raw material to do this with, is to create a viable economy outside of the system. I know that the owner of Gab is trying to do this. There's a few others. Trump may try to do this to some extent anyway. There are a few halfway decent people with money who recognize what's going on. But, you know, I've defined nationalism. Originally, I've done this in Occidental Quarterly in places like this, that nationalism is the politicization of what I call the structures of survival. All of these traditions come from some sort of pressure, maybe foreign occupation or extreme anxiety, whatever it is. It's the concept of humanizing everything around you. To a great extent, that's what culture is, of humanizing nature, humanizing the market, whatever it is, and that eliminates anxiety. This is why you didn't have tons of mental illness, except for, you know, congenital stuff, in the Middle Ages and early modernity. Now, nothing is humanized. Everything is alien. Everything is an imposition. And so today, you have media censorship. You have everything censored. No one even knows how to argue this anymore. How many times have we come across people who don't know how to put together a logical argument? I mean, I know college professors who can't. They have no idea how this goes. They don't know what a fallacy is. By eliminating tradition and custom and nation that, on which it's based, you eliminate humanity. You eliminate logic. You eliminate basic cognition. And only now, although we predicted this for a long time, do you see what happens when you eliminate this stuff. You eliminate humanity. You have passive hunks of matter living, well, that's what the whole zombie metaphor. is based on what mass society is, what the postmodern man is. The zombie can't learn anything, doesn't understand anything. It lives solely by its lower appetites, doesn't think, just moves forward propelled by these passions. And you know, the American culture has been obsessed with zombies for about a decade now, because that is what the mass man is. That is what is created by the elimination of these traditions. These aren't just arbitrary things that someone invented. These slowly developed. This is how humanity has been able to insert itself into the natural order as a part of it, and thus to eliminate anxiety, to eliminate depression, because we all have this to live for. We have each other, and we have our connection to God. That's why farmers are so conservative. They see how the natural order works, and reducing them to hicks and yokels is so dehumanizing and damaging, because they're putting white trash and all this. You use these languages, you use these terms to justify destroying them. They're not really people. That's all they are. Well, white trash is what you get when you eliminate their connection to the land. Small farmers can't really function anymore. So that's what's happening here. And it's complicated, but we're learning now. This is what happens when you remove the humanization of nature. You get freaks. You get these freaks on my 600-pound line, which is maybe why I'm so addicted to the damn show. They're not even human at this point. They can't think. They can't utilize logic. It's an absolute disaster. But it also means this is what makes the rich richer.
Well, if we go back to the 1950s, it is interesting to note Union Carbide corporate narrative based on a series of images that depicted the company as a hand of God coming out of the sky to solve some of the issues facing humanity. One of the most famous images is of the hand pouring the firm's agrochemicals on Indian soils, as if traditional farming practices were somehow backwards. Despite well-publicized claims to the contrary, this chemical-driven approach did not lead to higher food production. According to the paper New Histories of the Green Revolution, written by Professor Glenn Stone, however, it has had long-term devastating ecological, social, and economic consequences. See Vandana Shiva's book, The Violence of the Green Revolution, and Bhaskar Save's now famous and highly insightful open letter to Indian officials. And that actually led to 250,000 Indian farmers committing suicide since 1995. In the book Food and Cultural Studies by Bob Ashley et al., we see how some years ago a Coca-Cola TV ad campaign sold its product to an audience which associated modernity with a sugary drink and depicted ancient Aboriginal beliefs as harmful, ignorant, and outdated. Coke and not rain became the giver of life to the parched. This type of ideology forms part of a wider strategy to discredit traditional cultures and portray them as being deficient and in need of assistance from godlike corporations. What we are seeing now is an acceleration of such processes. In terms of food and agriculture, traditional farming in places like India will be under increasing pressure from the big tech giants and agribusiness to open up to lab-grown food, GMOs, genetically engineered soil microbes, data harvesting tools and drones and other disruptive technologies. The Great Reset includes farmerless farms being manned by driverless machines, monitored by drones and doused with chemicals to produce commodity crops from patented GM seeds for industrial biomatter to be processed and constituted into something resembling food. But what will happen to the farmers? Post-COVID, the World Bank talks about helping countries get back on track in return for structural reforms. Are tens of millions of smallholder farmers to be enticed from their land in return for individual debt relief and universal basic income? The displacement of these farmers and the subsequent destruction of rural communities and their cultures were something the Gates Foundation once called for and cynically termed land mobility. Cut through the euphemisms, and it is clear that Bill Gates and the other incredibly rich individuals behind the Great Reset is an old-fashioned colonialist who supports the time-honored dispossessive strategies of imperialism, whether this involves mining, appropriating and commodifying farmer knowledge, accelerating the transfer of research and seeds to corporations, or facilitating intellectual property piracy and seed monopolies created through IP laws and seed regulations. With a link completely severed between food production, nature, and culturally embedded beliefs that give meaning and expression to life, we will be left with the individual human who exists on lab-based food, who is reliant on income from the state, and who is stripped of satisfying productive endeavour and genuine self-fulfillment. Well, I would suggest faith does help to give you self-fulfillment and to give you a sense of purpose through all these dark times. But Matt, what are your final thoughts on all of this today?
The great way to summarize what we've been talking about is simply to say that if you're embedded in a strong national, ethnic, culture, locality, community, church, etc., you don't need the regime. Therefore, the regime has to destroy all this to make you utterly dependent on them. Their profit depends on the destruction of nationhood and tradition. I suppose the only exception for farmers would be if you grow opium poppies. Other than that, you're in a lot of trouble in the future.
Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Matt. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with more of the Daily Nationalist for you. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.